Welcome to the multimedia security lecture. We started to talk about watermarking last week, and this week I would like to continue and put a little bit more emphasis on these criteria for good watermarks that we mentioned last time. So particularly robustness of watermarks, watermark security, and fidelity. So the thing that a watermark is ideally imperceptible. Okay, but first of all, some details with respect to the organization. So I think, like, after today, you essentially know enough buzzwords or something to just make an attempt to screen the literature a little bit. And I will put three papers, two or three papers on Stud.on, and I would like you to have a look at them. Yeah, you don't need to go through them line by line, but it would be great if you could see, okay, can I grasp the core idea? How can I sort these papers into what we've discussed so far? Yeah, so how does it fit into that framework? For example, what do they do with respect to robustness? What do they do with respect to perceptual fidelity? Things like that. That would be questions that would be relevant in order to get an idea, okay, like how advanced is this work? How solid is this work? I mean, okay, hopefully they're all solid, yeah, but okay, no, to be able to argue about the content of the methods in actual publications. So this is not staged or something, yeah? Okay. But on the other hand, if you, I don't know, if you look at an equation and it all doesn't make sense or so, then don't worry, yeah? I will come back to this next week then. So I'll upload these papers tonight to Stud.on, and then you have a week to look at them. And at the beginning of the lecture next week, I think we could just talk about them like for half an hour or so and then move on. Okay, so that was one thing. The other thing is if you have the schedule in mind that I originally proposed for the lecture, then you notice that I'm deviating a little bit. Okay, so that was the draft for the schedule. I'm deviating a little bit. Oops. Is that large enough? Big enough? So then we are, like, if we are next week, if we are also talking a little bit at least about watermarking, you see that watermarking takes, I mean, fingerprinting is sort of the watermarking thing, yeah, but that watermarking will take more space, a little bit more space than anticipated. I think that's fine. It's an important topic. And signal processing in the encrypted domain is maybe more like a fun topic, but it's not super central to multimedia security, I'd say. So we will have a little bit wait here, and I'll just squeeze that in some corner or so. And then we also had a request to do an exercise on steganography or steganalysis, which is, I think it's a great idea, but it's something that I cannot accommodate by just doing like 1 hour, like, run over this topic and then create an exercise on that. So I will probably also take a little bit more time to talk about steganography and steg analysis. Yeah. So I'm squeezing the other topics a little bit to the side. I think we can do that. There's not a fixed obligation to do this or that specifically. And adjust a little bit the schedule. Yeah. But this also means, like, if you have some specific requests or desires or so, then just tell me, yeah, and we can address them. Okay. So yeah, it's not a big change. It's just to inform you that you know what is going on. Okay. Good. Now, are there any questions with respect to that, or should I just go on? I think I go on. So last time we saw two simple embedding schemes. And I will add two preliminary things before talking about robustness, fidelity, and security. that I think are just important to know. So one thing is, up until now, we were only able to embed binary messages, or that is also what we did in the exercises. Yeah. So we can embed either a zero or a single zero or a single one into a document, but there might be, or there are plenty of applications where we actually would like to embed more information, so a higher payload in terms of the watermarking language into a document. So at such a higher payload, I mean, there are a lot of possibilities to achieve that. What would be a possibility that would be a direct, just a hack of the system that we already have from the exercises, or will have next Thursday? How can we encode more than a single bit? Okay, let's go one step back. How did we encode a single bit? First of all, if we detect our watermark, we can either, like, at the end of the day, we know, oh, it's a zero or it's a one. How did we do that? Let me see if I have the exercise worksheet here somewhere. That's too wide. Right. So here's that. Oh, no, sorry. Now here's that. So here's the claim. Both schemes in this exercise, this is the worksheet for the exercises, both schemes are only able to embed a single zero or a single one into the image. Thus, the payload of the methods is one. So how did we distinguish that? It's that line here, no? If the watermark shall encode a global zero, multiply this binary or this additive term that we add to the watermark, multiply it by -1. Yeah. So that means if we correlate our stored watermark with the actual image content, we obtain a correlation that is either positive or negative. And depending on that, we say, oh, it's a zero or it's a one. Yeah. Okay. And then I think quite natural, if we think about, for example, this 8x8 block and embedding scheme, we could just say so that we embed sequences of 0s and 1s by embedding in each block in like 1 bit. No? I mean, that's almost too simple. Yeah. So embed sequences of 0s and 1s into an image. By embedding 1 bit per block. That's an example. Yeah, there are multiple possibilities to do that. That is probably the most simplistic way to achieve this. Yeah. Okay, but this, when we now think of robustness, yeah, so the image might be recoded or so, and we're trying to recover our watermark again, we have that problem that our watermark information has a much, much smaller spatial support now to be extracted from there. So we can expect some noise in that extraction, right? And maybe some bits are just wrongly extracted just because we have less pixels available. Yeah. So, what can we do against that? Essentially, you can say anything because anything has been proposed. Everything has been proposed here. There are hundreds of papers. Everyone put his idea in. So we have a noisy extraction process. Yeah. Now we're saying instead of embedding 1 bit into a full image, we subdivide the image into blocks, estimate the watermark per block. Only so that constitutes our binary string. Things only get worse, right? I mean, if extraction from the whole image was noisy, extraction from such a small area must be much noisier. No? So what might be a way to recover that message? Get that message through the channel. We can do that. Yeah, we can add some redundancy. That would be straightforward, and it would be very natural in terms of what we did in the exercises, because there we were repeating every single block. No, now we could say we repeat sequences of blocks. No, that's okay. There's another way. Thinking of the bachelor's program, yeah. So when you repeat the signal, then you sort of double the number of, like, you double the space that you need, yeah. And the robustness that you gain is not so much more. I mean, it's also doubled, but there are trickier ways also. Yeah.
Well, we might arrange those blocks into blocks parity, right? And add some parity bits to be able to recover some
portions. We add some parity bits, yes. So that means, so essentially we did define a code on top of these blocks. Yeah, that's a nice idea actually, because if you think of, Huffman coding, for example, yeah, you add just a couple of bits, but you get some robustness to in the case that you get one or two blocks or so wrong somewhere. Yeah. And then in terms of codes, of course, there are plenty of codes that might be useful. But here's a nice scheme. It's a so-called trellis code, which is nice to use in that context. Picture. Something's not clear or ambiguous, or just ask your questions if you. I don't know. Are there questions?
So how do you add the conjunction between Huffman code? Or, like, I know how Huffman works.
Am I mixing things up? So you have like 8 bits message. Maybe I don't mean Huffman, but what do I mean then? If you add to an 8-bit message, 3 additional bits, for example, yeah, then we have a total code word length of 11, and we can encode 256 signs. Now the bit distance. I mean, now the interesting question is, okay. If my decoding fails, it translates to having bits wrong here. Yeah. So the interesting thing is, like, how many failures can I detect? And the second interesting thing is, how many failures can I correct? Yeah. Maybe I don't mean the word Huffman. What word do I mean then? Hamming, thank you. Hamming distance. Yeah. All right. Let me write this down because, you know, in my age. Anyways, thanks for picking this up. So the Hamming distance, yeah? So if I have these 3 redundancy bits, I should be able to at least correct 1 bit, right? Can maybe correct even 2. I don't know. I forgot the details. Your bachelor is closer than mine. Anyways, you know what that all is about, yeah? Okay, and here's another code. There are a lot of these codes. Here's a nice one in terms of this lecture, and also, as it will turn out, in conjunction with pattern analysis. It's a so-called trellis code. I can write this down, but that is a trellis code. Encodes. So hold on, I have a formulation for this. So it encodes a binary string. As a path through a graph. And that graph is called a trellis. So that is where the name comes from. Okay, and essentially it encodes each edge in 4 bits. Okay. So let's look at such an example graph once you wrote this down. Sure. Okay, we will see. Okay, so here's such an example graph. We always start to encode the message at node A. And if the first symbol is a zero, we follow the thin line. If the first symbol is a one, we follow the thicker line. Yeah? So that means a zero is converted to four zeros, and a one is converted to three zeros and a one. And then depending on what that symbol was, we got to a new state. Yeah? Like either state A or state B. And then we look at the second symbol. If it's a one, we follow the thick line. So in that case, we would enter a 0011 bit string. If it's a thin line, if it's a zero, we follow the thin line and we write down 1100. Yeah? Okay, and depending on what that bit sequence is, we obtain a path through that graph, that creates a bit sequence that is four times as long as our input bit sequence. And we can, for example, append two zeros or something to the end of our sequence to indicate that this is the end. So we have a total of four times as many bits as our input sequence plus eight more bits because we have those two zeros in the end, or one actually, one's four bit more because the last zero is then discarded. Okay. And as you can see, the difference between individual elements along that path is not necessarily so large. Yeah. Like, for example, here we either have four zeros or we have three zeros and a one. Yeah. But the nice thing, the funny thing is that if we follow this path, we are in a different state afterwards. So that means that the subsequent sequence, so the sequence as a whole, that will be quite different depending on what path we took through that graph. So we can encode a binary string as a path through a graph and encode each edge in four bits. We can, before encoding, append two zeros, 00, to bit string. To mark the end. Okay. And then when it comes to decoding, so this can be embedded just in a sequence of blocks. Now, when it comes to decoding, we need to decode the string as a whole. It only makes sense as a whole. So it turns out that the decoding looks for the most likely state sequence my chalk decomposes. So the most likely state sequence through the trellis. Given the observations, of course. And now, okay, most of you probably did not attend pattern analysis, but when you think of hidden Markov models recovering the most likely state sequence, that was done using Viterbi's algorithm. And it turns out that we can also use Viterbi's algorithm here to get the most likely state sequence. So this can be done with the so-called Viterbi algorithm. This is a dynamic programming solution, so it's efficient, it's optimal. And I'm happy to tell you how it works if you're interested. So dynamic programming, so that means it's like quadratic complexity or something. So it's definitely affordable. Okay, so these are options to be a little bit more, to gain a little bit robustness when it comes to encoding full bit sequences in the watermark. And at the end of the day, it helps to, I mean, more robustness can also be traded for increased payload. So we can say, okay, then let's make the spatial support for each bit a little bit lower, but and instead embed more bits of the watermark, something like that. Yeah, so you can trade one quantity for another. Yeah. Good. So that is a way to get multiple bits embedded. The second thing, which I think I said last time, or at least I said during the exercises, but did not really explain well, is that there's always that option either to embed a watermark in spatial domain, that is what we have been doing, or to embed the watermark in frequency domain, or some combination thereof. So embedding the watermark in frequency domain, what does it mean? Yes, please.
I don't know how much details we need to know about this, but I'm not sure if I got the idea of this trellis.
Okay.
Right. So I assume the encoder and the decoder both know the trellis structure.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
So it's sure if I have, for example, state E, I can decompute, I can only go to state E from a certain amount of states.
Yes, let's have a look at the graph again. Yes, that's absolutely right.
I only encode the edges. So if I have the edges, so what I see, the information I have is the edges. So
yes.
If I have an error in this encoding, I would have to assume what the proper encoded edge was by knowing in which state I am or could end up and get the most probable correct edge encoding, right? So I have state F, and then I get a encoded edge, which I know it's not correct, right? In the signal. So how does the robustness add it?
So. So,
do I need to start the decode from the end and go back?
Do you start to decode from the end? No, I don't think so. It's not necessarily. But maybe you have to modify. You don't even have to. No, I think the algorithm is really the same, like in PA. So we know that we start in state one. We know that we start in A. Yeah. By convention, we say we always start in A. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Now, what options do we have? If we think we observe a 0, 0, 0, 0, that means we remain in A. If we believe that we observe a 0, 0, 0, 1, we think that we rather move to B. Now, things continue. So if the next symbol looks like a 0, 0, 0 again, then we certainly remain in A. If the next symbol looks like a 0, 0, 0, 1, we go to B. Or the other option would be that actually we already were in B. Now what can happen here? So either we observe a 1, 1, 0, 0 and go to C. Or we observe a 0, 0, 1, 1 and go to D. Now our sequence up until now didn't cross at any point, so that means we need to evaluate all those options. So the binary strings that we are comparing are up until now are those two versus those two. So and that's where we see like the codes these paths start to diverge and like the longer the path gets, the less chances there to mix them up by occasionally. Yeah. So the paths only start to meet, I think, after four steps or something like that. And there are some more details attached to this whole thing and so on. Yeah. But okay, so we do a couple of steps before. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So
or at the fourth step, we have the collision.
And
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Our signal I want to decode is 0, 0. I would go to A and to A again. Mm-hmm. And compare to the next signal, which has the lowest signal distance, which is 0, 1, for example. Mm-hmm. I would, in this example, end up in B. Or if I have signal 1, 0, I would end up in C, which is already at least a 1-bit difference, or in the case of 1, 0, even a 3-bit difference in the decoded signal. Right? So I follow the path to B, and then to C, difference to the 0, 0 decoder.
Yeah, but actually, I think we have to do two more steps here to see how things end, because okay, let me say at each state we have to look back and say, okay, what is the most likely input? But up until here, we only had one possibility for input. Like after a subsequence of length 2, there was only one path leading to state B. No? So therefore, we have to go one step further. We can still remain in A. We still have the possibility to be after 3 steps in state B. We can also go after 3 steps to C if we now have 1100, or we can be in D if we have 0011. Now if we look at C and D, yeah, so C goes to E and F, and D goes to G and H. So now after the third step, we spanned the whole trellis, yeah, like we are in, let me not write it too thoroughly, yeah. So we have C goes to E and F, and D goes to G and H. So now we are in a situation, we have 8 nodes. So at every, like after every step, we visit 2 times more nodes. Yeah. So now we're sitting on all nodes. No? Now if we make now the next step, yeah, we can, for example, have a look at our A again. Yeah. Might be another 0. Or how could we also end up in A? We could come from E. So that would be a 0010 path. And how did we get to E? We had a 1010 from C. Okay. And here at this point, we have to wonder, okay, is it more likely, like, is that sequence of all zeros more likely? Or is that sequence over this path more likely? And what is that path? Fortunately, it's unique, so we can tell very precisely. So we have 0010, 1010, 1100, 0001. So half of all these entries, not exactly, a little bit less than half, but almost half of these entries are ones. Yeah. And that is what helps us to distinguish this path from that path. Yeah. And very similar to, we could have now a 0001 here that leads to B. What is our alternative to get to B? Oh, again, we come from E. So from E it's 1001 that leads to B. Yeah. So and now we have to make that decision. Was it this path or was it that path? And then
I try to determine, like, perhaps with regards to a certain amount of expected failure rates, I try to determine the most likely outcome, right?
Yes, yes.
But my question would be, how can I encode a message that is not starting with an A?
Ah, the A is just a placeholder. So what you actually encode, so this stands for a 0 and this stands for a 1. And the A is the hidden state that you're never interested in. Just for your orientation in this graph, because so if you have a 0, you follow the thin link. If you have a 1, you follow the thick link. And depending on where you are in here, you end up going somewhere else and putting other bit strings in here. So you have to make some agreement. Like, yeah, okay, I start at A. I always start at A, no? Because otherwise it's too confusing. Yeah.
Okay, so my payload could be 0 or 1, and to
Yes. So that's a little bit more expensive then. Yeah. 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 I mean, this is just one example for adding robustness via encoding, no? But I don't know. I like that graph structure. So yeah.
If you do not transmit the hidden states, and only the zeros for the atoms, how do you know that you ended up in an A again? For this example, will you have the sequence of all ones or?
So the receiver knows the graph structure. So the receiver, up until here, the receiver has to take all possibilities into account. Yeah. And in the next step, it's actually true that the receiver also must take all possibilities into account. Now, when we talk about A here, we say, okay, let us hypothesize that we are for the fourth symbol or what? In state A. So assumed it would be A. Is it then more likely that we came over this path, or is it more likely that we came over that path? And then we can make a decision. No, we can say, no, we had a couple of ones at specific positions, so we prefer this path. Yeah. Okay, and then we say, okay, so let's note down this path. So that is the dynamic programming part, actually. So this is where the DP comes in. Yeah. And we only keep that path which is more likely here. So we say if it was A, it was certainly more likely that we came over that path. And then we apply the same reasoning for B. Say, so let's assume that we are for that fourth state in B. Then if we look at that sequence, is it more likely that we came with that bit sequence here, or more likely that we came with that bit sequence here? And so again, we make a decision here. And making that decision means that we can ignore the other option. Yeah. And that helps to always like keep the number of overall options manageable, because the number of possible paths grows, doubles with every step, but we don't want to keep track of that many paths. So here we are throwing out options. Yeah. And then in the next step, we do exactly the same thing again, because also here, if there's here is another E, that E also links up here. Yeah. So again, here we ask the same question. If in the fifth step we came to that state, would it be more likely that we came from here, or would it be more likely that we came from there? And in order to determine how likely it is that we came from here, we take the probability of that path, which we determined to be more likely here, and add the probability of having a couple of zeros here. No? So that is the dynamic programming thing. And this extends over all eight states. So we go step by step, and then state by state, always throw out the less likely option and continue to the next state, throw out the less likely option, and so on. No? Yes. Yes.
Where does the probability come from? Do we just define it? What's more probable?
We can just say we count how many zeros and ones did we detect at the right position. No? Because we also have an order here. Like we say, first come two ones and then come two zeros. And either we have the ones and zeros there or we don't. No? Repair, yeah. Right. So, right, so adding such a longer code, it's just one aspect of robustness, as we will see in a minute. So the other thing is also that, like, as soon as we start to make assumptions, for example, we assume that the image will be JPEG encoded or things like that, no? Then we also introduce specific operations that we expect and to which we would like to be robust by design. So it would not be appropriate to rely on such a coding scheme if we make such a specific assumption like the image will be JPEG compressed. Then in that case, it makes more sense to think about, okay, how does the JPEG algorithm work? And then what can I do to sort of serve along with the algorithm, not disturb the algorithm doesn't disturb me, and we're all good, yeah? So do you know how JPEG works, roughly? Is that? I can very quickly illustrate that. Did you attend this Hello World seminar from the Computer Science 2 from there? No one? So there are always these dynamic programming exercises. Okay. Good. Yeah, JPEG. So the JPEG algorithm, oops, let me put up a picture. It's a Wikipedia picture. Anyways, it serves the purpose. So the JPEG algorithm, it looks always at 8x8 pixel areas in the image. So let's call this an 8x8 pixel area, or consider this as an 8x8 pixel area, and sort of fits functions to that little block. Yeah, so the simplest function is just a homogeneous area. Yeah, the next simplest function is maybe a horizontal transition from bright to dark, or a vertical transition from bright to dark. If we flip the sign, then that function could also go from dark to bright. Yeah, or here from dark to bright in vertical direction. And then we can do further subdivisions. Like, instead of going from bright to dark, you can also go bright, dark, bright, or here, bright, dark, bright, dark. Okay, so apparently it's a frequency transform, yeah? And we have these frequencies in vertical and in horizontal directions, yeah? And actually the basis functions for that are cosines. That is why it's called a discrete cosine transform. So, we convert colors from RGB to another color space. It's called YCBCR. We can talk about this in a minute. It's not a super critical step right now. Then we subdivide the image into 8x8 pixel blocks. And then comes this interpolation into horizontal and vertical cosines. And the function looks like, whoa, but it's really not so complicated when the first shock is gone. So let's say I is the stupid letter. Maybe we take F. F would be good. Let's take F. So the frequency component, so the coefficient for the so-and-so manyth basis function. So these frequency components are basis functions, essentially. The kth one in horizontal direction, the lth one in vertical direction, or vice versa, equals just the sum, a double sum, from I equals 0 to n minus 1, j equals 0 to m minus 1, and then we have some coefficient xij, and then cosine of 2j plus 1 times 2k plus 1 pi divided by 4n, and in the other direction multiplied by cosine of 2i plus 1 times 2l plus 1 pi divided by 4m. And this is for 0 lower than k, lower than n. And j is also in the range between 0 and m. Okay. So this is the discrete cosine transform. This flickering light, it makes me crazy. Okay, good. And similar to the Fourier transform, which you certainly know from other lectures, these images, image intensities, these are all real values, and so on and so on, all friendly properties. It's a one-to-one mapping also, yeah, from the 64 pixels in spatial domain, so the normal picture space that we look at things, and to the 64 coefficients or basis functions. So basis coefficients that we compute by projecting that patch onto these cosines. Yeah. So let me just make a remark. Note that the 64 DCT coefficients exactly represent the 64 pixels. So we have no loss here up until now. Yeah, and we could compute an inverse discrete cosine transform that would just exactly restore the original image. But what is done now? I mean, the whole goal of JPEG is to reduce file sizes, not to compress the image. So, as a matter of fact, the eye is less, human eye is less sensitive to high frequency components than to low frequency components. So this means these cosines with a very high frequency, we can attenuate them a lot because we don't see them anyways. Yeah. And that is actually where the information is thrown away. And that is a quantization step that comes now. So quantization discards high frequencies, yeah? Typically. I mean, we could do it differently, but let's keep it simple. And the quantization can be expressed, so the finally compressed pixels C, K, L, so frequencies, can be expressed like something like F, K, L, so our frequencies, divided by some quantization coefficient Q, K, L, and rounded in some weird way that every vendor does differently. Yeah. So let me just express this as this hook down, hook up, left. Yeah. So we round up or round down, where Q, K, L is a quantization factor. That is large, chosen to be larger for higher frequencies. And higher quantization, so this means we divide by more and then we round to a full number, so it means we lose more information. Okay, and then we can do a run length encoding and we're done. Yeah. So and then we do run length encoding. Encoding of all quantized coefficients C, K, L for all blocks store them. So these run lengths encoded, no? Then we need to store our dictionary for the run length encoding. I guess, do we? That would be Huffman, indeed, yeah. I think we need the dictionary, yeah. It's not important, we never look at it. And what we certainly also need to store, and that is something that we look at more often, is this quantization, the list of quantization factors. Yeah, and that is something that we, for example, also use in image forensics, because it turns out that these quantization factors are specific to certain devices or to certain software. The quantization factors. So they are specific for a vendor or software or whatever. Like everyone chooses them as he or she likes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And then with this information, we can decode the image by essentially going backwards. Yeah. So this means we take our dictionary if we stored it. Sorry for it's really not the most important thing in the algorithm. We undo the run length encoding. Yeah. So that means we have these coefficients. Then we multiply each coefficient by the respective quantization value. We lost a little bit information because we rounded up or down, but we said no one sees this loss, like with human his or her human eye, so it doesn't matter. Then we do the inverse discrete cosine transform. The equation for that is essentially identical to that equation. Depends on how you chose this xij, but don't worry about this. Yeah. So essentially you do these sums again, and then you go from you put all your 8x8 blocks together to a mosaic of your image and transform it back to RGB space. And there's your image. Yeah? Good. Yes. Yes. Yeah, I skipped that. Yeah. There are some more details. Yeah. So you mean the color subsampling? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that is true. So the reason I was skipping a little bit here. But okay, since we mentioned it already. So RGB is our normal color representation, red, green, and blue stimulus. Yeah. YCBCR stands for, so Y is luminosity, so the brightness in the image. Yeah. Can think of it like a grayscale channel representation of the picture. CB and CR stand for chromaticity, blue and red. Yeah. Okay. And the rationale is that okay, if we know the brightness, if we know blue and the blue portion and the red portion, then we can also deduce from that the green portion. So there's no need to explicitly store also that. Yeah. And that again is, so the choice of that color space is also perceptually motivated because our eyes are more sensitive to luminosity rather than to any color changes. Yeah. And this means if we are a little bit more careful in compressing the luminosity, maybe we would like to have a separate quantization table also for the luminosity, then we can go very aggressive on the colors and no one will see the difference in the picture. Yeah. And going aggressive on the colors, it does not only mean maybe that we use a larger quantization table here, but as Patrick indicated, it can also mean that we spatially subsample the red and blue colors and don't take 8x8 blocks for the color channels, but instead 16x16 blocks, but also just compress them to 64 coefficients. Yeah, and to further dispose of information here. Yeah. So these are some. Yeah, it's all about space, no? Some tricks to save space. This transformation, so from here to here, is not complicated. So the luminosity is just a weighted sum of red, green, and blue, for example. Yeah. Good. So that's a lot of information, but let's think about it, how to make use of it in terms of robustness. If, let me check the time. Yes. So we said high frequencies are preferably thrown away because the assumption is that humans don't see them anyways. So that means any watermark embedding in high frequencies would be a waste because JPEG would destroy it. Yeah, the JPEG compression would destroy it. Unless you would like on purpose to embed something that breaks after JPEG compression. Yeah. So these are some niche use cases. But we're interested in robustness. So that means we need to embed. We can embed our watermark also by adding it just to these quantized coefficients. Yeah. We can do pretty much the same embedding as we did it on the pixels. We just add on some coefficients, but we would not take high frequency coefficients, but coefficients with a middle frequency or a low frequency. Yeah. So high frequency high frequency coefficients are expected to be destroyed by JPEG compression. So this means, or this implies a robust watermark embedding must be done into low or middle frequencies. And we can say the embedding itself can be done analogously in DCT domain. Sorry, that's word order. Can in DCT domain be done analogously, whatever, to the spatial domain. Hold on, we have to fix the word order. Sorry for that. Spatial domain. Just add the watermark to the coefficients C, L, K. Yeah. Right, the word order. The embedding in DCT domain can be done analogously. So the itself doesn't have any meaning anyways. So, okay. That goes here. Can be done analogously to spatial domain. Yeah. Yes.
When we are talking about high frequency coefficients, do those correlate to regions in a picture with high changes in colors?
Yes. Or brightness, preferably, because we said, okay, color is also subject to a strong compression. No? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We can browse a little bit on Flickr and look at pictures. What should I search for? Do you see something? No, you don't. Tell me a search term. Seriously, say something.
Kittens.
Good. Okay. So the internet is reliable. Okay, let's look at an example picture. I don't know. Downloads. Okay. Okay. So let's have a look at that picture and in terms of frequency content, yeah? So, can you see that? Yeah. actually, yeah, anyways. Okay, so if we have sharp edges, yeah? That is something that creates frequency responses all across the place, yeah? This would be considered a low frequency, like an area with little texture, no? Similarly here in the background and so on, no? Now, if you think about these DCT basis functions that we looked at, yeah? And now look at this area. So here we only have this frequency in horizontal direction. In horizontal direction, we have a high frequency because these hairs, is that visible? At your position, so there are bright hairs going up, yeah? So we have a high frequency in horizontal direction, but we have a very low frequency in vertical direction, almost nothing happening, yeah? So in terms of these basis functions, let's have a look again at our basis functions, yeah? So here we have the lowest frequency, so nothing's happening at all. Here we have in X and Y direction the highest frequency, so every pixel flips the brightness. Yeah? And if we have only in one direction a strong frequency component, we are somewhere here in either that row, this row for horizontal frequencies or that row in vertical frequencies, yeah? And like the more we go towards this corner, the higher it gets in both directions, yeah? But the quantization coefficients in these JPEG compressors are typically designed in a way that, so they take everything out, so you can forget about it, yeah? And so particularly, I mean, it depends, do you publish your picture on the web, then you would like to have it much smaller than if you publish it somewhere else or so. But particularly for pictures on the web, so these coefficients oftentimes are all zero. They're just like the quantization coefficients here are so large that when you divide by them and round, that you end up with a zero. And then it's like, oh, cool, run length encoding on a bunch of zeros. I mean, that's perfect, no? And that's exactly the purpose, no? Okay. Oh yeah, here we would see structure that goes in both directions, probably. Yeah. Naja. Okay. I think it's clear. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Good. Now, now I'm running out of time to really nicely talk about fidelity, but at least a little bit, I should at least say a little bit about it. Because otherwise, what we wrote to the blackboard so far is not very practical. So it is true, a robust watermark embedding must be done into low and middle frequencies if we expect any kind of JPEG compression. Yeah. but the problem is, or in practice, we still only embed watermarks into middle frequencies. Yeah. So we don't use the low frequencies. And that is because our perception is so sensitive to these low frequencies, no? So exactly the same reason why the JPEG people are preserving these frequencies, we are not putting our watermark in there, because then it's much easier seen by the eye than if going to the middle frequencies, yeah? And that is the whole thing about the fidelity. So the fidelity is that one constraint that oftentimes sort of breaks everything, not really breaks, but slows down everything, yeah? In terms of, okay, don't embed here, no? That's too strongly visible, or don't put more payload in here, yeah? Because then it becomes too strongly visible. That's always the same story, and that's always because of that requirement that the watermark should be visually unobtrusive. And visually unobtrusive, there is a term to characterize that. There should be just noticeable differences, yeah? Or we're trying to stay within just noticeable differences. Fidelity. So any changes or any modifications to the picture or video or audio file or whatever should be confined within so-called just noticeable differences. So these are oftentimes abbreviated JND. Yeah, and depending on, So the usual workflow is you make an assumption on what just noticeable differences are, maybe rooted in some perceptual model, typically delivered by psychologists, and then you have some quantitative criterion what you can do. Like that is the super golden way, clean solution, how to define your just noticeable differences. And there are a lot of details attached to that that can quickly make it complicated. For the moment, we should maybe just start to clarify that statement that we wrote up here. So therefore, for DCT embeddings, we do not use the low frequencies. Only middle frequencies. Okay. And just to give you another like term. Many watermarks are perceptually shaped. Yeah. Or masked. To be embedded in areas where they remain within these J and Ds. Yeah, let's think about that cat picture again. No, so so we certainly, if we have very homogeneous areas, yeah, there we mostly have only low frequency content. Yeah, so that means we would put only a very weak watermark signal in there or none at all. Yeah, so that means we can make our embedding strength alpha. Like the way we did it last Thursday in the exercises, we had a global alpha for the whole picture. We don't need to do that. We could say, okay, for homogeneous areas, we choose a very low value for alpha to maintain that fidelity. And for other areas, like textured areas, where we have plenty of these middle frequencies that we like for our embedding, there we can increase the alpha and put a stronger watermark signal in there. Yeah. So that is something that that helps the fidelity. It also has a second advantage because in these highly textured regions typically also carry the key information of the picture, no? So the content of the picture. So that means it's something that cannot easily be removed without really changing the picture. When we think about watermark security, so someone on purpose attacking the watermark, then we make it harder for an attacker if we embed watermarks in more textured areas than in flat areas. Because, for example, in flat areas, what would be a nice attack to any watermark embedding in a flat area? What could we do?
Just mean filter it out or something?
Yeah, mean filter sounds great. No? Also, bilateral filter is probably devastating. Yeah, right. No? So, but these filters, they also have to be edge preserving in a way or so. So if we have more edgy regions and embed there, we're probably doing good. Yeah. Okay. Good. Yeah. Let's discuss this next time. So I put these two or three papers up tonight. Yeah. Have a look at it, maybe for an hour or 1.5 hours or two. Yeah, something like that. It's hard to, I don't know. So here's the thing, yeah? What I want to say is have a look at it for 2 days, yeah? Because if you're not used to read these papers, it takes you 2 days, yeah? But then on the other hand, if I say that, probably no one is going to do it. So it's okay, yeah? So why not 2 hours, no? And see how far you get, yeah? I know that it's complicated to read these papers if you're not used to reading them, yeah? But you know a little bit of the vocabulary, and we see like how far we get, and we're gonna talk about it then next Monday a little bit. And we can also, if you like, we can also already on Thursday talk about it a little bit in the exercises, but we don't need to. I mean, just if you're interested. Okay, good, then thank you.